depends on the initial conditions from inflation, to learn about the nature of the dark matter and dark energy, and also to constrain alternative theories of gravity. The initial conditions of the universe can be summarized on a single sheet of paper, which is quite remarkable. This is the sheet of paper. And there are thousands of books in libraries around the globe trying to summarize the present state of the universe. So there is a lot of complexity nowadays. All of it started from these very simple initial conditions. In principle, if you put them into a computer and you have the correct Lagrangian, you should be able to predict even present-day politics. Right? Now, so far, we have an image of the universe when it was about 400,000 years old. That's when the universe became transparent to the cosmic microwave background. And we have lots of images of galaxies when the universe aged by another billion years or so. But we are missing some pages in this photo album of the universe. In fact, most of the volume of the universe was not probed, as I'll show in a minute. And that would be the goal of future observations. The current picture is rather simple. Early on, there were small density fluctuations imprinted on the uniform background. And due to the attractive nature of gravity, overdense regions became even denser with time, and eventually material was assembled into collapsed objects. The material was drained out of the voids that separate the objects that we see nowadays. So this is the picture of gravitational instability. And for pedagogical purposes, I would like to stress that the best evidence we have for the fact that most of the matter in the universe is weakly interacting or not interacting electromagnetically comes actually from this very simple fact that the microwave anisotropies, when you plot the amplitude as a function of angular scale or multiple index of spherical harmonics, there is a very sharp decline in the amplitude of the power spectrum on small scales. And the reason for that is simple, photon diffusion. Photons are diffusing and smoothing out fluctuations on small scales, the effect of silk damping. And because of that, we see this decline in the power spectrum of microwave background anisotropies. If most of the matter in the universe was coupled to the radiation, we will not have fluctuations on scales of order 200 megaparsecs and less. So this peak in the power spectrum corresponds to present-day scales of 200 megaparsecs. Galaxies are assembled from scales of order a few megaparsecs. The reasons that galaxies exist is because there is another component of matter, which we call dark matter, that does not couple to the radiation, and therefore it keeps memory of the initial conditions, the initial fluctuations of small scales. And this is actually the best evidence we have that there is this form of matter that does not pay attention to what the radiation is doing and keeps memory of the initial fluctuations of small scales. Now, the baryons, the gas in the universe, of course, does get coupled to the radiation, and therefore, early on, shortly after the universe became transparent to the microwave background, there were no fluctuations on very small scales in the baryons, but later on, the baryons fell into the potential wells of the dark matter, and that's how the first objects formed in the universe. For the power spectrum of lambda CDM, the first objects to form in the universe are on small scales. So in fact, the dark matter is clumpy on scales of the order of Jupiter's mass. But the baryons are unable to assemble into such small scales because of their gas pressure. And so there is this concept of the Jeans mass, the minimum mass into which baryons can assemble in the universe so that gravity overcomes pressure. And that's of the order of 10 to the 5 solar masses. So the first objects to collect gas into them had masses of order 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 solar masses at around the redshift of 30 or so. And you can see those regions here. This is a cut from a numerical simulation. As these yellow dots, these are the regions that Jeans mass objects that first potentially collected gas that could have made the first stars. Now, there are two ways to trace the baryons in the universe. First, you can go after the galaxies, the clusters of stars that form in the universe, and assume that they trace the dark matter distribution. on large scales, at least, you expect those galaxies to follow the dark matter with some bias that, in principle, you can attempt to measure. So in fact, this is a very popular approach that people are using to map the dark matter distribution in the late universe by following the distribution of galaxies. The second is to follow the distribution of the diffuse gas, and that's what I'll focus on in my talk. And we do have images of high redshift galaxies, the sort of first generation of galaxies. The deepest image we have is from the Hubble Space Telescope. You can see an illustration of it here. And there are all kinds of objects in it, some of which at the bottom here, the red objects, are redshifted. They are at redshifts of order 5 to 6, most of them. And as far as probing the universe, right now we are able to see galaxies all the way to a little less than 1 billion years after the Big Bang. But we know that that's a redshift of order 6 or so. We know that galaxies started to form at redshifts of several tens, as I mentioned. So in fact, this is another illustration of what the Hubble Deep Field revealed, slices of galaxies at multiple epochs, all the way up to redshift 6 or 7. And those very high redshift galaxies look a bit different than the galaxies we see nowadays. They are smaller, and they seem to be disturbed. They are interacting. Of course, the goal is to be able to image the very first galaxies in the universe, and that will be done, hopefully, with the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope called the James Webb Space Telescope that is scheduled to be launched in about 5 years or so. And we hope that this 5-year interval between the time that we speak about it and the time that it will be launched will shrink with time in the future, unlike with the Hubble Space Telescope. There are also plans for very large telescopes, construction of very large telescopes on the ground that will go after the first galaxies. And here are two examples. There is the giant Magellan Telescope that includes 7 mirrors, each of them 8.4 meters in diameter. And the two other telescopes, the 30-meter telescope is illustrated here, which is segmented. And then the European Extremely Large Telescope that is also segmented and is planned to go all the way up to 40 meters in diameter. So one of the main initiatives, motivations for these telescopes is to be able to image the first galaxies. But let me focus on the other alternative of mapping the matter in the universe, which is to map the diffuse gas. Hydrogen, as we all know, in its ground state, has actually a split state. You can have the electron line up parallel to the proton in terms of its spin, or anti-parallel to the proton in terms of its spin. And the higher state is above the lower state. The transition corresponds to a photon with a wavelength of 21 centimeters, 1.4 gigahertz. This was already recognized about 60 years ago and observed by Ed Purcell. So this transition is well known and being used in astrophysics. And in this context, one defines the so-called spin temperature, which is simply telling us the relative population of the two levels, the number density of atoms in the upper state over the number density of atoms in the lower state, through a Boltzmann factor that has the spin temperature in it. 0.07 degrees Kelvin is the energy difference between the two levels. And G1 over G0 is the spin degeneracy factor, which is 3 for this case. So in the universe as a whole, I mean, we know that hydrogen was created at a redshift of 1,000. That's why the universe became transparent. And then at some later time, the UV radiation from the stars, from the galaxies, broke the hydrogen into its constituent electrons and protons. So that was the process of reionization that Joanna alluded to. And when neutral hydrogen filled up the universe, there were two main processes that controlled the spin temperature that I mentioned before. The first is atomic collisions, that coupled the spin temperature to the kinetic temperature of the gas. And the second is the radiative coupling to the microwave background radiation that coupled the spin temperature to the microwave background temperature. And these two temperatures need not be the same. So this is a schematic illustration for what happened as the first galaxies came into the scene. At early times, in fact, the gas was cooler than the microwave background, as I'll describe in a minute. And then the first galaxies popped up and produced the ionized bubbles around them, and these bubbles eventually overlapped. And if you are trying to map the hydrogen, what you would see is that at early times, you're mapping the density inhomogeneities in the hydrogen. And then at late times, the bubbles appear as cavities in the hydrogen distribution. So you will see these giant bubbles of ionized hydrogen produced by the first generation of galaxies. And if you're imaging these bubbles, you are actually doing something similar to slicing Swiss cheese. The holes in the Swiss cheese are the bubbles, the ionized bubbles that I was referring to. And we can do it in three dimensions because we can map the hydrogen on the sky, in two dimensions on the sky, and then do it at multiple wavelengths or frequencies. And each wavelength corresponds to slicing the universe at a different redshift. So we have a three-dimensional map of the hydrogen distribution of the universe. Now, why is this exciting? What you see here in the top left panel is an illustration of the fraction of the observable volume of the universe that was probed so far. The wealth of cosmological information that we have right now is based on mapping just a tenth of a percent of the available volume of the observable universe. Just 10 to the minus 3 of the observable volume of the universe was mapped so far. That includes the cosmic microwave background, which is a very thin shell. It's actually two-dimensional, coming from the last scattering surface at a redshift of 1,000. So we can map, we can Fourier decompose the density fluctuations on this shell, and we get a two-dimensional map of the density fluctuations at a redshift of 1,000. It's a very thin shell. And then we have, for example, galaxy surveys at low redshifts. In red here is illustrated the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, the luminous red galaxies, which occupy a volume of the order of 10 to the minus 3 of the comoving volume of the observable universe. So we have just used 0.001 of the available volume at our disposal so far. And what matters for setting cosmological constraints is, within the survey volume, how many independent modes can you fit? So if you have a mode of a particular wavelength, if you Fourier decompose the density fluctuations, and you consider a mode of a particular wavelength, then within your survey volume, you can fit then a number of modes which is equal to the volume divided by the wavelength cubed. And the bigger the volume is, the more modes, independent regions you have so that you can constrain the power spectrum better. And so in principle, we can improve our constraints by three orders of magnitude on cosmological parameters. And that's the main message that I would like to convey today. And there are some numbers mentioned here that I will not get into that will appear in Physical Review letters within a few weeks. It's from a paper that we published. Now, if we get much better, tighter constraints on the power spectrum, what we see here, for example, is the current constraints coming from not just galaxy clustering, but also the Lyman alpha forest, gravitational lensing, the cosmic microwave background in red. This is the this shows you the amplitude of fluctuations as a function of wave number. And we don't know much about very high wave numbers or small scales. And of course, the nice thing about mapping the hydrogen distribution is that you can go to much smaller scales, because the effect of photon diffusion that is truncated, the microwave background anisotropies on small scales, does not operate here. Here we're talking about the gas that fell into the gravitational potential wells set by the dark matter. And the gas can do that all the way down to scales of arc seconds on the sky, or 10 to the 6 solar masses. The Jeans mass that I mentioned before corresponds to arc seconds on the sky instead of the damping of the microwave background on scales of a few degrees or less. So indeed, we can go to much smaller scales than we can go to with the microwave background radiation. And we may reveal some surprises here in terms of the initial conditions from inflation. Now, how do we separate the physics from the astrophysics? That's a very important question. Because as you know, much of astrophysics deals with things which do not relate to the topics I mentioned before. Now, first I need to define what I mean by physics versus astrophysics. I'm sure that there are some astrophysicists in the audience and they would like to know what makes them different from the physicists. And the way I define it is that astrophysics is anything that has to do with star formation. Now, you may wonder, star formation, why isn't that physics? Well, the reason is that star formation has to do with a very large dynamic range of scales. And we cannot really understand it from basic principles at the moment. You can't just write a Lagrangian, put it into the computer, and derive how stars form. People have phenomenological models for how stars form. And therefore, the models that we have are not very predictive. So whenever you are making stars or making galaxies, you can parameterize your ignorance with some fudge factors, but you can't really pin down the deviation of the spectral index from scale invariance based on your model of star formation. That doesn't make much sense. So astrophysics is anything to do with consequences of star formation. And what I mean by physics, I defined already at the beginning. So how do we separate the physics from the astrophysics? Before the first galaxies formed, obviously, we are in the regime where physics applies, because there are no galaxies, there are no stars, therefore it must be physics. That's what the microwave background does. It probes the initial conditions of the universe at an early enough time, at the redshift of 1,000, before the first galaxies formed, and therefore it's a very clean probe of the initial conditions of the universe. So, in principle, it's possible to probe the 21 centimeter in absorption at very high redshifts before the first galaxies form. Also, during the process of reionization, one can look for fluctuations in the 21 centimeter power spectrum due to peculiar velocities. And I'll explain how that can be used to separate the physics from the astrophysics in a minute. And then after reionization is over, you might think that there is no neutral hydrogen left in the universe. But in fact, there is. We observe it. A few percent of the baryons are still trapped in galaxies in dense enough knots of gas so that the gas is shielded against the background UV radiation. And so the fact that there is still hydrogen left over at low redshifts allows you to map. You don't need to resolve individual galaxies. You can just map the hydrogen distribution on large scales and get the power spectrum of density fluctuations. Similar to doing a galaxy survey, but without probing the individual galaxies. So this is an illustration from a paper that is soon to be posted on Physical Review, D, of all the expected signal for 21 centimeter fluctuations throughout cosmic history. Starting at a redshift of 200, that's when the baryons decoupled thermally from the microwave background. There was some residual electron fraction left over after recombination that coupled the temperature of the baryons to the microwave background down to a redshift of 200, and only then the baryons decoupled and cooled faster because they are non-relativistic, cooled faster than the microwave background did. And you can see here the amplitude of expected fluctuations as a function of redshift for different wave numbers. So different line types correspond to different wave numbers. Initially, the signal is in absorption, because if you calculate the spin temperature of the gas, it turns out to be negative. In this upper left panel, the dotted line corresponds to the microwave background temperature, and then the other lines correspond to the spin temperature in different models. And the spin temperature dips below the microwave background temperature, so the gas appears in absorption. And as soon as the first galaxies form, they produce X-ray radiation that hits the gas above the microwave background and allows the 21 centimeter transition to appear in emission rather than absorption before the gas gets ionized. And so the brightness temperature, the global brightness temperature of the gas is initially negative, and then it goes positive. And these are the amplitudes that you get on different scales from a direct calculation of these fluctuations. Now, what is shown in these diagonal lines is the level to which you need to remove the foreground. The biggest obstacle to observing the 21 centimeter fluctuations is that there is a synchrotron foreground from our galaxy. Relativistic electrons gyrating around the magnetic field of our galaxy produce continuum emission, synchrotron radiation, at the same frequencies. We're talking about very low frequencies, hundreds of megahertz. And the thing is that the synchrotron radiation is smooth as a function of frequency, while the cosmological signal fluctuates as a function of redshift. And so by changing a little bit the frequency, you are looking at the universe at a different redshift. You are slicing the universe at a different location, and the signal should fluctuate on small frequency shifts. So the way to remove the foreground, even though it's much brighter, is by fitting it to a polynomial and then looking for the small ripples on top of that. And the level to which you need to remove the foreground is shown by these red lines. In order to observe the epoch of reionization, you really need to remove it to a level of 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6. And if you want to observe the dark ages before the first galaxy is formed, you really need to remove it to a level of order 10 minus 7, which is in principle doable, for example, on the moon. These are the 21 centimeter fluctuations before the first galaxy is formed. That's from a relatively old paper 4 years ago. And you can see here that indeed the peak in the fluctuations is on scales of arc seconds, or L of order a million, instead of L of order 1,000, where it is for the, or a few hundred, where it is for the cosmic microwave background, L of 200 or so. And so clearly the 21 centimeter fluctuations allow you to probe much smaller scales that are still at high redshifts, still in the linear regime. And it became sort of an industry over the past couple of years to try and make maps of the 21 centimeter fluctuations. You can see here several examples. For example, here at the top, you see the brightness temperature. And these red regions are regions in which hydrogen was ionized by galaxies. And eventually, these bubbles of ionized hydrogen overlap at relatively low redshifts. So this is as a function of redshift going to the left, starting from a redshift of 18, going down to 12 or 10. And let me show you one of these numerical simulations that people have been doing just to illustrate what it looks like. So you can see here, these are simulations of reionization. So what you're seeing is how quickly the bubbles overlap and eventually eliminate the neutral hydrogen. Now, I mentioned that in principle, even during the process of reionization, you can separate the physics from the astrophysics. So let me explain how that can be done. And that is basically due to the effect of peculiar velocities. So the brightness temperature of the hydrogen is proportional to the optical depth of hydrogen, how much column of hydrogen you have that resonates with the photons that you're looking at. And the point is that the optical depth of the hydrogen is, of course, proportional to the hydrogen density, say, at a given point in space. But it's also inversely proportional to the derivative of the velocity of the gas along the line of sight. And the reason it is sensitive to that is because we know that there is a Hubble expansion. And so atoms, because of this expansion, atoms move away from resonance due to the Doppler effect. So if you're observing a particular point in space, once you're moving away from that point, there will be gas elements that are shifted in the resonance relative to the frequency that you're looking at. And the bigger the velocity gradient is, the less optical depth you get for the absorption or the emission. And so the optical depth is inversely proportional to the radial derivative of the radial velocity component. Now, if you have a density enhancement around this point, obviously you'll get an increase in the optical depth because the density is higher. But at the same time, the Hubble parameter is modified because now there is more mass in that region and therefore more gravity that is slowing down the expansion. And as a result of that, the Hubble parameter is modified again by roughly the same factor. So peculiar velocities do matter for the power spectrum of 21 centimeter fluctuations. And if you Fourier decompose the fluctuations in terms of K vectors, modes, and consider, for example, relative to the line of sight, a mode that has a K wave vector that is aligned with an angle theta relative to the line of sight, then this radial derivative of the radial component of the velocity boils down to adding two factors of cosine theta to the power spectrum. So you end up with a term which is not isotropic. There is an anisotropy in the power spectrum depending on what is the direction of the K vector relative to the line of sight. So you're used to the power spectrum being just a function of the wave number, but in fact it's a function of the wave vector, the direction relative to the line of sight. And the power spectrum has an isotropic component, which, by the way, has contributions from astrophysics, lots of them. But if you have, for example, bubble structure in the universe, there will be a contribution to the power spectrum. But there is no preferred direction in the universe, and this would contribute only to the isotropic component. And therefore, by isolating the cosine squared term, you can, in principle, identify the term that originated, that was sourced by peculiar velocities. And peculiar velocities measure gravity. And therefore, you can go after the physics, the initial conditions from inflation, and isolate it from all the contributions to the isotropic component. So there is a way to extract physics even during the epoch of free ionization. Now, there are a bunch of experiments going on. In fact, we had a conference at Harvard a couple of weeks ago that was very interesting. These are the experiments. There is the Murchison Wide Field Array that we are partners in, which is taking place in Western Australia. There is LOFAR, the low frequency array, which is taking place in the Netherlands. And then there are some other experiments that are less well funded, and they are taking place in actually in very good sites in China, another one in India. So there is clearly a lot of work being done in this direction, and here is an illustration of how, for example, a tile of radio antennas, we are talking about dipoles, the same type of antennas that are used for TV reception that were used back in the 60s, Lenny can testify to that. In fact, I should highlight Lenny's talk tomorrow because one of the interesting things that can be constrained is a curvature in the universe. And please stay tuned to Lenny's talk. Why would that be interesting? And we basically put lots of these dipoles together, thousands of them. You might ask, why wasn't this done back in the 60s or 70s? The issue is really computing power. Only now we have, with the Moore's law, we have sufficient computer power to process all the necessary information. There is a huge amount of information coming through these 10,000 dipoles. And only now we're able to process it. So this is really made feasible by computer technology. And these dipoles would be spread across an area of about a kilometer. And you can see here an illustration of what it might look like. We are putting it in this particular case in Western Australia, where there is roughly one person per square kilometer. In that, you can see kangaroos in that area, but no people. And this is how a dipole looks like. And as I mentioned, the biggest challenge is the foreground, the synchrotron foreground from our galaxy, but all the calculations so far indicate that it should be doable. We should be able to pick up the cosmological signal, and you can see an illustration of that here for different experiments. LOFAR is in red, the MWA, the Murchison Wide Field Array, is in blue, and the signal is this black line here, which is certainly above the sensitivity limits of these experiments as a function of wave number. And these are just the first generation of experiments funded at a level of $10 million. nothing compared to the investment we've made into, for example, the microwave background WMAP or the more ambitious JDAM missions that Paul mentioned before at the level of $1 billion. Obviously, if $1 billion would be invested in this frontier, we would get a wealth of information from it. But it makes sense to go step by step first to see that we can actually remove the foreground. But there is a lot of potential to this method. And as I mentioned, it's possible to probe the hydrogen after the universe got ionized simply because there are pockets of hydrogen left over in the universe. And there are some early calculations that indicate that it should be possible to extract that signal. And of course, one of the things you can do at low redshift is go after the acoustic oscillations. And here, I mean, you must have heard it many times, but let me repeat. If you perturb the universe at a point, say, during the epoch of inflation, there would be a sound wave propagating outwards in the radiation fluid. And then at a redshift of 1,000, the gas decouples from the radiation, and then you let it, this signature is imprinted on the gas, and you can recover it later on when you look at the universe of the gas distribution at later times. If you take the Fourier transform of sort of a circular ring of a sound wave propagating away from a point, you will get the fundamental mode, which has a wavelength equal to this size of the cavity, and you get all the higher harmonics. And that's the origin of the acoustic oscillations that you see. And we see it in the microwave background. We see it in the galaxy distribution at redshift 0.3. And we can see it also in the 21 centimeter brightness fluctuations all the way from high redshifts. And I showed here different components of cosine theta that I referred to before. And also at low redshifts. This is sort of an illustration of the oscillations that you can extract at low redshifts. And in principle, you can measure those, the location, the value of K that corresponds to these acoustic oscillations to a precision of 1% or so if you invest enough funds in this frontier. And of course, one can go after neutrinos, the signature of neutrinos on the power spectrum, and the calculations indicate that you can detect neutrino masses of order 0.05 eV of the level that are suspected based on atmospheric neutrinos. So let me summarize. 21 centimeter fluctuations in principle allow us to probe most of the volume of the observable universe, starting from redshift 0 all the way up to, in principle, redshift 100 or 200. Most of the comoving volume was not probed yet. It's 99.9% of the volume of the observable universe was not mapped as of yet. And in principle, one can constrain dark energy at the low redshift end. And then neutrino masses and alternative models of gravity can, in principle, be constrained. I didn't have time to get into that. But if we observe how the power spectrum evolves with cosmic time, we can see if the growth of the density fluctuations follows general relativity. And if it doesn't, then we know that GR might be modified. So mapping structure in the universe at multiple redshifts allows you to see also how it evolved, how the amplitude of fluctuations evolved with cosmic time, which is a very powerful probe. We don't have that at the moment. Thank you.
There's time for one short question. Everybody wants coffee.
What is your best guess on the limits that you can determine the curvature to?
Well, it depends on how ambitious the experiment gets. The most optimistic, I would say we can probably, if you invest hundreds of millions or in such an experiment, you can get down to 10⁻³. 1 order of magnitude better than the CMB.
Okay, we'll resume in about half an hour. Thank you.